I think there are things we can do to make the system better. But here's the heart, because a financial system is a man-made system. So it all comes back to law and the enforcement of the law. And I think the challenge, the big challenge with the current system, if you look at the system in a lot of the Western democracies, you know, on paper, it's quite good. It really is quite good. The problem is that, you know, our respecting each other's rights has been financed by running around the world and disrespecting other people's rights. So if we're going to rebalance the global economy, we have to come up with a way of respecting each other's rights globally. And the reality is we either respect everybody's rights or respect nobody's rights. It's one or all. And so how do we create a legal system where we respect each other's rights, not just in terms of, you know, I see you and you see me and I don't hit you and you don't hit me, but how do I hold that non-violation into the financing? So how do I not finance companies that violate you and you not finance companies that violate me or governments or people? So we have to do that non-violation, not just individually, but financially and economically. And that, again, comes back to this question of law. How do we enforce the law? Because I believe if you pile down all through the enforcement question, the biggest question is we all have to enforce it. You know, the reality is, Bonnie, if you're Mr. Global, so you'll just play Mr. Global, and you have weather control machines, and you have machines that can induce earthquakes, and you have nuclear weapons, and you have lasers that can be beamed, you know, down at me from space. The only way I can enforce against that is if millions of people are willing to act in concert with their prayers, with their actions, and with their investments, and say, you know something? You may have all the most powerful weapons in the world, but, you know, we're not going along. Gandhi did have the formula. So either we're going to institute the law as a cultural matter and move up to that level of responsibility, or we're gonna be governed in a slave society. So we have a choice between a very dark sort of high-tech medieval feudalism, or we're willing to step up as a global culture and say, okay, I'm willing to practice non-violation, not just in my actions, but in my transactions. And if we can do that as a culture, then we are many and they are few. And I don't care how many weather control machines you have. It's a big planet. It takes a lot of people to run it. And the minute the rest of us say, look, whatever we do, we want to have a human culture, not an inhuman culture. And that's our choice.
And we need a critical mass of people to agree with that and act on it.
Right. But act on it in very savvy ways. Because what I see, you know, I'm not an activist, but I've sort of stepped in and out of the activist community. And what I see in lots of activist communities is they are unbelievably naive about who's running things and how things are being run. I just got into a little thing on the email because somebody said, oh, good, let's all get a Google Circle. And I said, oh, great, why don't we make it easy for them to monitor in a function where they own and control our content? Are you out of your mind? You know, these organizations weren't created to serve you. They were created for different purposes, and their goal is to monitor and manage you. And I think we need to be, you know, we need to be very savvy, number one, about what's going on. But also part of that is admitting we don't know what's going on. And I think the first most important thing we all need to do is to ask and answer that question. Who's really running things? Why are they behaving the way they're behaving? Because we are acting in very naive ways. And naivete to that extent is a violation of our responsibility. It's everybody's responsibility. And here's why. Because part of this globalization process is what can be done to one can be done to any. You know, 9/11 was the proof. And, you know, I'm just going to say something racial. You know, white people thought that the black budget guys were just going to rape minority communities, not everybody. 9/11 was the wake-up call to say, you know something? Everybody's fair game. So now we have, you know, very successful office workers jumping out of burning buildings. And the reality is the black budget boys are willing to take out anybody. Everybody's fair game. So in that sense, it's a new day. Now, it's funny because I wrote an article about 9/11 at one point. I sent it to you, Meditations at the Crossroads, where I said, look, You know, the black budget operations have been killing Americans for generations. You know, we have the nuclear testing. We have the different sort of sprays on the population. Now we have chemtrails being sprayed on our heads. Good heavens knows what that's about. You know, we have narcotics trafficking. We have all sorts of covert operations. We have all sorts of government leaders, presidents who were assassinated on television, you know, right in front of us. So many, many people have died. And what's interesting is if you go look at, as people are being killed in these variety of manners, you know, when you go in and you investigate, everybody's coming out with what solutions. Oh, you know, narcotics trafficking is bad or nuclear testing is bad. And what I say to all of them, wait a minute, forget the exact thing that killed your loved one. If you look at the number of people running the system, it's very small. And it seems to me what we all have in common is, you know, we have the fact that this small group of people have killed all of our loved ones. And they're killing us. So can we talk about that? You know, can we talk about who they are and why they're doing what they're doing? And, you know, this is not about your nuclear testing or your narcotics trafficking or your issue. I mean, I'll never forget, I have a wonderful relative who said to me, I was talking about the $4 trillion missing from the federal government. And she said, well, dear, you know, my issue is peace. The missing money's not my issue. And I said, you don't understand something. If they can steal $4 trillion in 4 years or 5 years, then they can buy everybody, which means they control all the issues. So it is your issue because it's a meta issue to your issue. And you know, and that's the challenge we have when we all look at these things place blind and people blind. And that's why I keep saying you have to come back to who's doing this, because the way that political control is exercised is by place. And when you exercise political control in a place, you're controlling all the political levers and all the economic levers. So you're acting cross-function. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Secret societies get people from all the different functions into the room on Wednesday night every week, and then they, you know, they coordinate cross-function, and then they go out and everybody says, oh, well, they can't possibly be coordinated because it's too complicated. There are too many functions. No. You know, they operate and think by ecosystem, and that's why they didn't want Community Wizard published, because it helped, you know, it helped people who'd never been trained to think that way to think that way.
And as you pointed out earlier, the planning, not only for the real estate bubble, but the financial coup d'etat in general, the changing of the laws, the work at FHA, HUD, et cetera, was extremely complex and took a lot of planning.
Right, right. It took a lot of planning by Treasury and the central bank and the intelligence agencies. It took a huge amount of planning. But the interesting thing to watch about it, and the devastating thing for me, was, you know, I tried to warn people. You know, so my immediate reaction was, I can't stop it, but, you know, it's too late. I tried to stop it, and that failed, so now I'm going to warn everybody. You know, everybody was making money. So you had thousands and thousands of mortgage brokers and thousands of home builders, and all of this was implemented by our family, our friends, ourselves. You know, this was all of us. We all participated, and most of us knew that it was terribly wrong. But we were making money. And what I saw was, as long as everybody was making money, you know, more government grants, more mortgages, houses going up in value, it's like, hey, let's have a party. And it was really scary. And what was the scariest thing about it, and I've told you this story many times, I got kicked off the radio here in the San Francisco Bay Area in 2008 before they nationalized Freddie and Fannie. And after they nationalized Freddie and Fannie, one of the biggest San Francisco money managers took a $1 billion loss on Fannie Mae stock that they had bought in March. So it got nationalized in August. They'd taken a $1 billion position in Fannie Mae in March. And they put a letter up on the website. And you could understand why they wanted me not on the radio at that time. Because they said, we did serious due diligence. There was no indication. We had no idea. Well, I said to myself, that's ridiculous. You have the former Assistant Secretary of Housing and the lead financial advisor to the Department of Housing and Urban Development on the radio in San Francisco for 5 years warning them that this was happening, that the fraud was this extensive. How could they not know? Every trucker in America knew. You know, every trucker knew. How could they not know? And there's this disassociation between you know, sort of how the system works globally and how it works locally, that is part of the integration that needs to happen. And that part of that is getting the government budget to be published in a transparent manner, both by function and by place. So here's what's amazing. You have the former Assistant Secretary of Housing, the former lead financial advisor to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, on the radio, in Asia, in Europe, here, on TV, on the internet, warning of this fraud. And literally no one could fathom that it was really, they couldn't fathom. One of my favorite financial blogosphere's commentator, Carl Deniger, is fabulous, wrote an article just last year where he called it, If This Is True, Kaboom. And the article is about the extent of the fraud and the fact that the fraud was intentional fraud on a massive scale, engineered at the highest level. And he starts the article off by saying, Catherine Austin Fitz has been saying this for a long time. And you can see what he's struggling with is he's struggling with the fact that what I was saying was really true. And he's finally beginning to fathom it. And that's how long it took. It took people that long to realize, oh, this is not a fraud. This is a plan engineered at the highest levels. And if you look at national security law, you know, I'm sure somebody has some argument as to why it's all legal.
And don't you have another story about a friend of yours who refused to believe what you were telling her about the fraud in the housing market, but then when she saw it on The Sopranos?
Oh, that was scary. If you look at the core financial, single-family financial fraud out of FHA, it's a particular kind of sort of fraud and way where you can launder money but triple and quadruple it and lever it tremendously. But the root fraud is a particular construct, and the Soprano TV show did a series of four shows on HUD fraud, very well done. I mean, very clever writing, very good acting on this core HUD fraud. And in fact, it was one of the first things that got me interested in money because I saw when I was a little girl, my neighborhood was destroyed. The real estate value was destroyed by four of those fraudulent deals done on the corner, and it wrecked the real estate market, sort of the value of the housing in that area. So it was one I saw as a child, and it's been, you know, it's been the common pattern for decades. Anyway, so I'd been trying to warn people, and a college roommate of mine who had come, in fact, to stay with me in Washington at the beginning of the litigation, the physical harassment was very dangerous. And I didn't want to live alone. So she had come and lived for a year and had dealt with a lot of the physical harassment with me. So she understood how dangerous the situation was. So the Soprano TV shows came on, and it was very interesting because they were done, I think, by HBO, which at the time was owned by Time Warner. And if you look at one of the board members of Time Warner, was the chairman of Fannie Mae. So this was coming top down. She called me and she said, Fitz, she said, everything you've been saying about the fraud is true. I said, pray tell, how is it that you finally figured that out? And she said, oh, well, you know, the Soprano TV shows, they're showing the HUD fraud. And I said, so the fact that the former Assistant Secretary of Housing and lead financial advisor is saying it is not credible, but the fact that it's on the Soprano TV show is credible. And she said, yes, that's right.
Isn't that too
Which
much?
Is, well, it led me to say, in America, fact is fiction and fiction is fact. So everybody knows it's socially acceptable to include it in reality if it's been approved by Hollywood. But it was very, you know, it was very frightening to me because you're trying to protect people from losing their money. And you're watching them literally, it's like watching cars drive off a cliff and there's nothing you can do to wave them down. They're ignoring you. You know, you're waving the flag and trying to stop them and they're driving off the cliff. And it was so terrifying because I saw millions and millions of people drive off the cliff and nothing I could do could get through. And I would do radio show after radio show and all sorts of articles and things on the internet. And what happened was you'd get a slow pitter-patter of people coming to you and they would take action. And you would see families who got out of the real estate market, you know, as the bubble rose and they repositioned their assets and they did all the different things that a family can do to protect themselves from being harvested in this environment. And you see those families get stronger and stronger and stronger, and then the other families just drive off the cliff. And one of the things I've thought about for years now is, what was it about those families who saw and took action and were willing to deal with it versus the ones who just drove off the cliff. And I've reached the conclusion, I've come to understand that I can help the people who want to be helped, but that we're going to watch millions of people just drive off the cliff. And it's been the hardest thing for me to come to grips with emotionally. How do I live watching people drive off the cliff and not go mad?